Hare Krishna, everyone. So this is the final session of Bhagavad Life, done in a slightly different way. Today I'm sitting in front of a recorder and in a room alone, and I have to say the experience is completely different. Over the last many weeks, we've all come together on a Sunday morning, and with great eagerness, with great enthusiasm and sincerity, we've all come together and discussed Srimad Bhagavatam, the grass jewel of all scriptures. And so many amazing things have come out. And I have to say, when I sit here in front of a recorder, it's a humbling experience, because I realize that whatever came out over the last weeks that we've been discussing, so much of the credit goes to all of you who, by your own eagerness and enthusiasm, so many points surface and so many insights come out which help each one of us. But I'll try my best today, because of the events of recent days and weeks, we are forced into doing it like this. It has been a very, very eventful week. Last Friday we heard about the coronavirus, and the news hit everyone. There was somewhat of a panic and chaos in the world. The temple had to take their own measures, and we were closed for a few days. And some of us also had to go into isolation, which I think some of the devotees went too unhappy about, because it gave us more time for reading, chanting, reflection. And it was a different type of Gaur Purnima. It was a Gaur Purnima in isolation, reading lots and trying to chant more rounds, and beautiful in a different way. So in whatever situation Krishna brings in this world, every situation is pregnant with an opportunity to deepen our relationship with Him. So we try to do that. And because of the ongoing situation with coronavirus and the apprehension in the world, we decided that it wouldn't be wise to hold a session this weekend, so we are concluding the course in this way. But the readings of Bhagavatam and the discussions of Bhagavatam go on eternally, as the Bhagavatam itself says, Nasta prayeshva bhadreshu nityam bhagavata sevaya. That Bhagavat seva, or listening to the Bhagavatam and trying to imbibe the teachings of Bhagavatam, nityam, should be an activity which is done again and again and again. So I'm sure it won't be too long before we're all together again discussing Srimad Bhagavatam face to face. It was also a very eventful week, because a few days ago our dear Shruti Dharma Prabhu, who was really an iconic figure here at Bhaktivedanta Mana, left the world in the most auspicious of situations. Naturally, it was a very great loss for all of us, because Shruti Dharma Prabhu was someone who lived, breathed Krishna consciousness. He gave every bit of his energy to try and share Krishna consciousness with others, and he left the world in such an exemplary way, and we're missing him so much, because we realize that life will never quite be the same without Shruti Dharma Prabhu, and the manner will never quite be the same without him. Yet at the same time, there's great happiness to know that we walked and we lived and we served alongside such a saintly person, and for that we are all eternally blessed. So I have a personal huge debt of gratitude to Shruti Dharma Prabhu, because I can practically see that whatever small things I was able to do in spiritual life was so much possible because of his encouragement and his support and his empowering words. So we all need Vaishnavas like that in our life. One sannyasi once said to me that the greatest gift you can have in your life is someone who has more faith in you than you have in yourself. So when we have devotees around us who have more faith in us than we have in ourselves, then they help us to go beyond the limitations and experience more, do more, and progress more in our spiritual life. So Shri Dharma Prabhu is such a wonderful personality, and we'll always remember him. So now we continue on with the 12th canto of Srimad Bhagavatam. As we know, every single canto of the Bhagavatam is focusing on different subject matters. Atra sarga visargascha sthanam poshanamutaya manvantare shanukata niroda muktirashraya. So from the beginning of the second canto, when the conversation between Parikshit and Sukadev began, then through the course of all the cantos, all the way up to canto 12, so many different subject matters were discussed. And now we come to the 12th canto, and the final subject matter to be discussed is Nirodha. Nirodha means annihilation. Because yes, everything has its time. Even when you buy something from the supermarket, then it has a best before date. Everything has a date on it. Our body, our life, our health, our relationships, our possessions, everything ultimately ends in annihilation in the material world. Everything material is annihilated. Krishna does this to help us understand what is of true value. Because everything that is material is annihilated, but everything that is spiritual is ever existing. And so by annihilating certain things, then Krishna helps us to become detached from them. And in this way, helps us to become more focused on the things that will never be annihilated. In other words, the things that are eternal. In other words, the things that are spiritual and will really nourish our soul. So as time goes by in life, everything will be annihilated. In Kali Yuga, which is the current age that we're living in, spirituality is gradually annihilated. Society, civilizations, and the way people live together, this is also gradually annihilated. Values, character of people, and relationships are annihilated. Even the body and the mind in the Kali Yuga is gradually annihilated. And finally, in this 12th canto, we'll also hear about how Maharaj Parikshit was also annihilated when he got bitten by the snake bird Takshak, and in this way came to the conclusion of his glorious life. The acronym that we've given for canto number 12 is NAME, because the final verse of Srimad Bhagavatam reveals Nam Sankirtanam Yasya Sarva Papa Pranashanam. The final verse of Srimad Bhagavatam says, take up the chanting of the holy names of Krishna, Sarva Papa Pranashanam, because then all inauspicious things within one's life and existence will automatically be eradicated. So yes, later on we'll hear in Srimad Bhagavatam 12th canto that Kalar dosha nide rajan asti hye ko mahan guna, that this Kali Yuga is an ocean of faults, yet there is one good quality. What is that? Kirtana deva Krishna siya mukta sangha param rajet, that if one takes up the chanting of Krishna's names in all seriousness, in all earnestness, with great determination, no matter how difficult it is, they carry on investing in their relationship with the holy name of Krishna, then that name will be the saving grace which will help them to move beyond all the difficulties of Kali Yuga. So in the midst of so much transitory, temporary things that surround us, each one of us have to ask ourselves the question, how much am I investing in the eternal? Because the Niti Shastra says, if you give up the eternal to pursue the temporary, then you will lose everything. But if you give up the temporary to pursue the eternal, then you will never lose anything. So what this means is that if you give up the eternal to pursue the temporary, you lose everything. Because the temporary things that you gain, you'll have to give them up. And because you never pursued your eternal, you will also lose that. But if you pursue the eternal, giving up the temporary, then you don't lose anything. Because someone may say, well, you're losing out on all of these things of the world, but ultimately you'll have to give those things up anyway. And you won't lose out on the eternal because you will have invested time and energy which will help you to carry that to the next life. So one who invests in eternal assets in their life, they leave this world as a rich person. Because they leave this world with something that they can actually carry with them. But if one does not invest in the eternal, then all their temporary acquisitions will not amount to anything when they have to move on. And therefore, how much have we invested in our eternal assets, our consciousness, our relationship with Krishna, our devotional bank account, our taste for the holy name, our enthusiasm and service attitude? These are our eternal assets. And therefore, in the midst of annihilation, in the midst of all this temporary, transitory world that we find ourselves in, let us, the Bhagavatam is saying, let us invest in the spiritual energy. So the 12th canto has four main sections, and the acronym NAME we have. So N stands for Nasty Age, because in the first few chapters of this 12th canto, Sukadev Goswami begins to narrate all of the characteristics and qualities of this nasty age, this Kali Yuga age that we're living in. And in this way, Sukadev Goswami opens our eyes to the reality of what life is and what life will become in this material world if we hang around for longer in Kali Yuga. In the next section, A stands for annihilation. Kali Yuga is the final age in the cosmic cycle, and we know at the end of Kali Yuga, everything is annihilated by the avatar, Kalki avatar. So in this section, different types of annihilation, really, which is the story of the material world, is just the story of annihilation. So we hear about the different types of annihilation. There are two types of universal annihilation, and there are two types of annihilation which is dealing with our own lives and our own experience of annihilation and death. And so these things are described in the second section of this 12th canto. M stands for Markandeya Rishi, who was a unique sage, a unique ascetic, because of the power of his vows and because of the power of his austerity, he was to some extent able to transcend and defy universal annihilation and live for an incredibly long period of time, even beyond annihilations. So when Parikshit hears about this, he requests to understand more about Markandeya Rishi, what he did, and some of his lessons from his life. And then E stands for ending the epic, because once this pastime is finished, then really the Srimad Bhagavatam comes to its natural conclusion. And Suta Goswami, to the sages of Naimisharanya, narrates the glories of this wonderful book and why everyone should take full advantage of reading the epic Srimad Bhagavatam, which can help one to gain everything that they so much desire in life. So let us now begin with the first section of the 12th canto, Nasty Age. So here I've written, the nasty age of Kali Yuga is vividly described, causing the Lord to eventually appear as Kalki to destroy all the irreligiosity in the world. I'm just going to take you back to the ninth canto of Srimad Bhagavatam. If you remember, the acronym for canto number 9 was DRAG. And the final section of that canto number 9, G, stands for God's Gotra. Gotra means family. So in that last section of chapter number 9, we heard of all the genealogy, all of the predecessors to Krishna coming, and all of the kings who ruled at different times in cosmic history. And then we learned about all of those illustrious personalities leading up to eventually the birth of Sri Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And once we reach Krishna, then we obviously go to the 10th canto, and in the 10th canto, everything about Krishna's life, pastimes, quality and characteristics was revealed. So what Sukadeva Goswami does in the beginning of the 12th canto of Srimad Bhagavatam is he goes back to that lineage. Now the lineage has already described all the kings coming up to Krishna. He begins to narrate how that lineage continues. Not only that, Sukadeva Goswami begins to go into the future, and he tells which kings will appear in that lineage in the future in Kali Yuga. And then he begins to predict the degradation of the kings in Kali Yuga. And as he begins to predict the degradation of the kings, then naturally he comes to start describing the degradation of society, which is a concomitant factor. And this really then is the first major teaching in the 12th canto, that corruption in the world, degradation in the world, will naturally come about if there is corruption in the leaders, if there is degradation in leaders. Leaders and their decline is the beginning of all inauspiciousness in any scenario or forum or organization or group of people. Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, yad yad acharati shreshtas tat tadeva taro jana sa yat pramanam kurute lokas tad anuvartate. Krishna says, whatever great people do, common people follow. And whatever standards they set by their exemplary acts, all the world pursues. So practically we see that so much of the degradation in the world today is taking place because of corrupt leaders. Broadly speaking, when we talk about leadership, we could outline so many qualities that are required of good leaders. But broadly speaking, there needs to be two things. There needs to be character, number one, and there needs to be competence, number two. Some leaders have good character, they have good qualities, they have a good heart, they have endearing personalities which naturally draw people towards them, and they actually have good motivations and a sincere desire to serve others. But if that character is not coupled with competence, they have to have vision, they have to have intelligence, they have to have strength and resilience, they have to have the ability to foresee things that will come that others can't see. If they don't simultaneously have the competence, then their ability to lead will be severely impaired. On the other hand, if someone has amazing competence, they have that resilience, vision, they're able to influence and mobilize people in a certain direction, but if that competence is not coupled with good character, in other words, a good heart, a good motivation to serve other people, if it's not coupled with character traits like humility, empathy, kindness, tolerance, if these character traits are not there, then even one has the competence, their leadership will not create positivity in the world. Because ultimately, that power that they will be given may well be misused. So broadly speaking, if we are to take up a leadership position, or if we are to try to identify someone who can take up a leadership position, then broadly speaking, these are the two areas in which we should look. We should look at their competence, but simultaneously we should also look at their character. And when one holds both of these together, then they can really do something nice for the people that they serve. So when Maya wants to attack the world, then naturally she will go for the leaders. Just like when we're preaching often, when we do preaching programs, and we see this even in Srila Prabhupada's life, then he wanted to meet the most influential people. We sometimes go and try to convince someone very, very eminent to take up Krishna consciousness, because we know if they will take it up, then that will perpetuate throughout society. So in the same way, Maya, she also employs the same techniques, that when she wants to spread her influence in the world, then she will cause very, very prominent and powerful leaders to deviate. And then those leaders will not just become victims of Kali, but they will also become the agents of Kali, who then spread that influence far and wide. So therefore, leadership is so, so important, because leadership is the protection against Kali Yuga, and leadership is the vehicle through which everyone can progress very powerfully on their spiritual journey. So as we go on, after hearing about the nasty kings in the nasty age of Kali Yuga, then we begin to hear of the nasty qualities that will then take root in the environment surrounding us. So as we read all of this, it's important that we realize that a lot of the reason why Sukadev Goswami is explaining the nasty qualities of Kali Yuga, number one, for us to be alert that these influences are there, and we should not feel that we are so strong that we are above everything, but that we have to be very alert not to be affected by such things. Another reason why Sukadev Goswami outlines the nasty qualities of Kali Yuga is so that we can assess, are we being affected by these things? Do I have these qualities within myself? Have I become influenced or compromised in the way I operate by the situation around me? And therefore, another reason is for our own self-reflection. And finally, it's important for us to know the qualities of Kali Yuga, so that we don't become surprised, or we don't become bewildered, or we don't become hopeless, or feeling that there is a major problems in the world, because Sukadev Goswami is warning us that there will be problems, there will be difficulties, and there will be struggles and obstacles, because that is the nature of the age we're living in. It's all part of the cosmic plan. So what are some of those symptoms that characterize Kali Yuga? There's an interesting story of a man who once came to see Yudhisthira. So as he came to the dwelling of the Pandavas, then Bhima was manning the door. So this individual came and he said, "I want to see Yudhisthira because I have some questions for him to ask." Bhima said, "Yudhisthira is sleeping. There's no question of you seeing him now. But if you like, you can ask me the questions, and I'm sure I'll be able to answer those questions." The man said, "I have seen some puzzling things in the world, and I'm not quite sure what I'm supposed to make of these things. So if you could kindly tell me what are the lessons I'm supposed to learn from each one of these things, then then job done. So Bhim said, I'm all ears, you can tell me, no problem. The man said, the first strange thing I saw as I walked around is that there was a field and it was surrounded by a fence, but that fence was slowly moving into the field, and not only was that fence moving in, but with it, it was eating all the different crops. What am I supposed to make of this? Bhim was baffled. The man said, the second thing I saw was there was a full jug of water, and then a person poured that full jug of water into 8 different cups, and after putting it in 8 different cups, they put the 8 cups of water back into the jug, but when they poured all of it back without dropping a single drop, only half of the jug was filled up. What does this mean? Bhim was baffled. The man said, the third thing I saw was that there was a man, and as I saw him, I saw something amazing, because he had managed to put an elephant through the eye of a needle. But after he had put the elephant through the eye of the needle, the tail of the elephant got stuck in the eye of the needle. So what am I supposed to make of this? Bhima was baffled. And then the man said, the final strange thing I saw was that there was a big boulder in the middle of the road. So many individuals tried to move that boulder, but they just couldn't budge it one little inch. And then after so many had tried, a sage nonchalantly walked up to the boulder, and this young, frail, ascetic monk with a string of his chadar, he managed to drag that boulder right off the road with a string of his chadar. How is it possible? What does this mean? Bhima was baffled. Bhima couldn't answer one of his questions. So he said, you know what, you better just go inside and speak to Yudhisthira. He is Dharmaraj, he is of great intelligence. He will be able to tell you the answers to these questions and the purports you need to derive. So the man indeed went in and he saw Yudhisthira Maharaj. And after some time he came out happy, content, fully satisfied in heart that he had received the answers he wanted. And Bhima, who was on the door, said, hey, come on, you can't just walk off like that. Tell me, what were the answers? What were the lessons you were supposed to learn? The man said, from my first sight, which was an agricultural field where the fence was coming in and eating the crops, Yudhisthira told me, this is the nature of leaders in Kali Yuga. Just like a fence is supposed to protect the agricultural field, a leader is also supposed to protect the citizens. But instead of doing that, what the leader does is begin imposing himself on the citizens, begin exploiting the citizens, and begin actually, instead of protecting them, using them for his own selfish ends. So this is, you should understand, Kali Yuga is coming, this will happen. The second one, where the full jug was poured into 8 cups and then poured back without a single drop spilling, but the jug only being half full at the end, Yudhisthira said, this relates to the way in which we give ourselves to others. What will happen is that as time goes by, people will give themselves to others. They'll give their time, they'll give their energy, they'll give their love, they'll give their resources, they'll give their faith to other people. But people, when they give back, they won't reciprocate in a fitting way. You may give full of yourself, but people may only give a quarter of themselves back. And in this way, relationships break down because there is no proper loving reciprocation. So he says, this is what it means. The jug was poured out, but when poured back in, it's not the same. So Yudhisthira said, don't be bewildered in Kali Yuga when people don't reciprocate with you properly. don't be bewildered if you give and give and give and give, but people don't give anything back. Because this is the nature of the age we're living in. Then the man said, I saw an elephant going through an eye of a needle, but then the tail got stuck. Yudhisthira told me the lesson. The lesson is that in Kali Yuga, so many big, big thieves will do so many big, big crimes, but all of those big thieves will get away with it. But then the small thief, the minor offender, the person who just does some negligible bad activity, that person will be caught, that person will be demonized, that person will be imprisoned. In other words, the big criminals go through, but the small criminals get caught. This is the nature of Kali Yuga. And then finally the man said, I saw a sadhu who was able, by the string of his chadar, by a thread of his chadar, to move a huge boulder that even the strongest of men couldn't budge. What does this mean? And Yudhisthira said, this is representing the holy name of Krishna. The thread from the chadar of the Vaishnava is like the thread of the holy name. And no matter how big the burden, no matter how big the boulder of Kali Yuga's defective qualities and obstacles are, by the thread of a holy name, everything can be moved. And therefore, despite the negative influences in Kali Yuga, one should never feel despondent, because within the negativity there is great hope, because we've come in contact with the holy name of Krishna. So like this, Sukadeva Goswami began to explain some of the qualities of Kali Yuga. Here, if you look on your slide, I've put some of the key things that were mentioned. He mentions in the first verse of the second chapter, religion, truthfulness, cleanliness, tolerance, mercy, all of these things decline in Kali Yuga. It said that society is founded upon four broad principles of dharmic life: austerity, cleanliness, mercy, and truthfulness. So it said that by the end of Satya Yuga, austerity is basically severely damaged. By the end of Dwapara Yuga, cleanliness is severely compromised. By the end of Dwapara Yuga, mercy is basically becoming more and more non-existent. And therefore in Kali Yuga, the only pillar that's remaining is truthfulness, but practically in Kali Yuga, even that quality of truthfulness is being compromised. Because studies show how many lies each person tells in a day. Small lies, big lies, white lies, bended truths, in whichever way, shape or form, people are just not truthful anymore. And because these qualities have gone, therefore Kali Yuga is considered such a degraded age. Tolerance goes down, mercy goes down, because even in our relationships, previously people used to appreciate each other. When they found it hard to do that, they would tolerate each other. And when they found it hard to do that, then they would fight with each other, but they'd fight in a very cultured, in a very righteous and dharmic way. But in Kali Yuga, it said that not only is there no appreciation, not only is there no tolerance, and not only is there no dharmic fighting, but basically people just end up criticizing, judging, fault finding and backbiting each other. That's the nature of relationships, how they decline over the cosmic time. So like this, we can see that duration of life, physical strength and memory will all diminish day by day. So everything diminishes, physical strength diminishes because of our diets, because of our surroundings, because of our lifestyle. Another place it says that Kali Yuga can be identified because as things become more worse, then one has to buy food. Of course, nowadays we all go into restaurants without a blink of an eyelid, but hundreds of years ago, the concept of having to pay for food was actually not really known by anyone, because everyone's house was practically an open slate, and anyone who wanted a meal could go into anyone's house. And if one was an ascetic, then they would be able to eat practically anywhere. When Kali Yuga gets worse, not only do you have to buy food, but you have to buy water. Of course, we all do this now, and it doesn't seem as though it's anything alarming. But the fact that we have to buy water, the most natural and the most simple and the most fundamental resource of existence, the fact that we have to buy it already shows how much degraded the world has become. And then it said that as Kali Yuga progresses even further, not only will you have to buy food, not only will you have to buy air, buy water, but the third thing is you will have to buy air. And if you go to some parts of the Far East even today, people actually walk about with a gas bottle on their back just so they can have proper air, because the air quality is so low in so many places. So no wonder the duration of life is going down, because our lifestyles are so artificial. It said that in this age, someone should generally be able to live to about 100 years old. But now, if you somehow make it to that grand age of 100 years old, you are a rare person, and even the Queen will send you a letter of appreciation for having survived so long. But practically no one can survive longer than 60, 70, 80 years. So this has already been predicted here, right here in the Bhagavatam. In the second verse of the Bhagavatam, it's mentioned that law and justice will be applied only on the basis of one's power. So here we see, yes, that might is right, that values have so much declined that the powerful people, the ones on the inside, the ones who have the contacts, the ones who have the network to push something through, can basically transcend or trump the justice system. And in this way, it's just depending on who you know and how much power they have, whether you'll be able to get justice or not. And so many times over history, we've seen so many articles related to this. In fact, it said that in Kali Yuga, the one of the major things that causes degradation, not just in Kali Yuga but in any Yuga, is money. The biblical adage tells us that money is the root of all evil, or love of money is the root of all evil. So we see that when money comes into something, it becomes degraded, it becomes compromised. Therefore, you'll find many monks. One of my cousins became a monk in another Hindu tradition, and he follows five vows. And one of the vows that they follow is that they will never, ever in their life, in any situation, touch money. They're just not allowed to touch money physically, because money causes degradation of one's mind, one's principles, one's heart. And in this way, not only does money destroy us on a personal level, or not only is money destructive on a personal level, if not dealt with appropriately, money is also the cause of so much degradation in the world. Because of money, lawyers have destroyed justice, because they're more interested in what money they'll get than actually bringing about proper justice in the world. Because of money, schools have basically compromised education. Nowadays, the way many schools are run is just like a business. It's not really about awakening true knowledge and wisdom within the child, but it's about how to run the school in such a way that it will be most economically lucrative for everyone. Hospitals have killed health because of money, because they no longer do what is best in the interests of the patient, but they do what is basically financially viable. We can also say because of money, the media has destroyed information. The media is meant to nourish us with information that can help us understand ourselves, our lives and the world around us in a much better way. But nowadays, the media is more interested in sensational stories which will help to attract viewers and buyers of newspapers rather than communicating what is truthful and beneficial for people. So we can see in Kali Yuga, because of the influence of greed and lust, everything declines. Here in the third verse it said, men and women will live together merely because of superficial attraction. We see that now the divorce rate is so high because the foundation upon which people come together is so shallow. Because people come together only on superficial attraction, then that relationship is very, very easily broken. There's no sense of deep commitment and love for each other. Love means to be selfless. So later on in the fourth verse here it says, one who is very clever at juggling words will be considered a learned scholar. So we see that someone doesn't even have to speak so much sense, but if they're able to speak very eloquently, if they're able to present themselves with stylish words and intelligent packaging, then they're considered a learned person, even though they may not actually know that much. Srila Prabhupada once gave the story of a student who went into an exam. And one of the questions on the exam paper was, who is Haridwar Basta? So the student had no idea who this person was. But then what he decided to do is do something quite unique on his exam paper. So what he did in answer to that question was he wrote, Haridwar Basta is a dough bendi lactylized by the plactony of Tinda. Just in case you didn't get that, I'll say it again. He said, Haridwar Basta is a dough bendi lactylized by the plactony of Tinda. In other words, he had no idea who Haridwar Basta was, but he just decided to make up any random sentence of words that weren't even found in the English dictionary and just put anything down without it having any substance whatsoever. When the marker read his answer, he thought, my God, this is such an ingenious student. I mean, he didn't just leave it blank. He actually endeavored to do something. And even though it's complete nonsense, because of his ingenuity, I'll give him a pass mark. So factually, he got all the answers wrong. What he said meant nothing. But because he had packaged it in a certain way, then he was passed. So Srila Prabhupada used this story to explain how in the world, it's not so much what you know, because people are so superficial, they just look at how you present it. And of course, as devotees, we can also learn from all of these things that it's not just about knowing the absolute truth, but because people are very much enamored by presentation, by how something is communicated in a interesting and entertaining way, that we also have to be employing such things in order to deliver them the transcendental message of Krishna consciousness. Later on here in the fifth verse it said, marriage will be arranged simply by verbal agreement. So this is also another thing we see so much in the world today, that people don't find it absolutely necessary to have a formal marriage. They say that we're committed to each other, we love each other, and we don't need a piece of paper to tell us that. But what they fail to realize is that the act of making vows, the act of formally acknowledging one's relationship with someone else creates an impression within the heart and an extra level of commitment that helps one to develop that relationship more and more and more. So while we're not a movement of rituals and just rules and regulations, some rituals and some rules and regulations are good because they can nourish our internal life and nourish our spirituality in different ways. Here in the final verse of this slide, in the sixth verse, it said, filling the belly will become the goal of life. So you see, people, the old adage says you should not live to eat, but you should eat to live. But we find people are living just to eat, eating all kinds of things, making all kinds of elaborate arrangements for cuisine, spending unthinkable amounts of money for you know, simple food, because filling the belly has become the goal of life. So here Bhagavatam says that these things are not the goal of life. Prabhupada often said, eating, sleeping, mating, defending, these are done by animals and humans. So it's not just about using your intelligence to eat in a more sophisticated way, but rather, dharmo hitesho adhiko vishesho dharmena hina pashubhi shamana, that one, if a human being does not take up dharma, deeper inquiry, one does not pursue the spiritual path, then pashubhi shamana is considered just like an animal. Just a two-legged animal, Prabhupada would say. So like this, so many things are predicted in Srimad Bhagavatam about the future. Often people say, like, what can your scripture say about the future? Are there any predictions? Are there any indications of what our destiny will be? So right here in the pages of Bhagavatam, which were written hundreds of years ago, we can see that all the predictions are practically coming true. I've just mentioned a few of them. There are so many more that could be described. And in this way, we see that Srimad Bhagavatam really is an infallible scripture, because it is basically revealing things beyond human perception. And in this way, Shastra has the broadest vision of life, because it will be able to indicate and enlighten us on information which is beyond the realm and the purview of our material sense perception. So this section of Srimad Bhagavatam then finally ends talking about the Kalki avatar, because when society gets so bad, when the degradation becomes so acute that there's no other way to resolve the situation, then the Lord Himself appears on a white horse with sword in hand, known as the Kalki avatar. And in that avatar, Krishna basically annihilates all material influence, all material people. And in this way, He almost does like a maha cleanup of the whole universe. And at the end of Kali Yuga, after this cleansing process has been done by the Lord, then Satya Yuga is re-established and the cosmic cycle then goes again. So this is what the Lord does. He appears at many different times. Yada yada hi dharmasya glanir bhavati bharata bhyuttanam dharmasya tadatmanam srijami aham. He comes to re-establish dharma and to remove all evil influence from the world. So in the Bhagavatam, the exact details of the Kalki avatar are given, where he will appear, who his parents will be, his activities, his character, and in this way we get an insight into who is the Kalki avatar, why does he come, and when will he come. So as we move on in the Bhagavatam, the next section A is dealing with annihilation. Now, I have to say, like, we're hearing all these different things in the 12th canto, nasty age, annihilation. It can all seem very, very depressing, very, very discouraging. We have to realize that we can only really become deep in our spiritual life when there is a very deep detachment from the world. I almost saw in the life of Shruti Dharma Prabhu that he was able in life to practically never be frustrated in any situation. Shruti Dharma Prabhu lived for 40 years in a Hare Krishna temple and served day in, day out. Now, on a daily basis, anyone who serves within the movement, not just serves within the movement, anyone who lives within the material world and tries to do anything will be faced with frustration. You're faced with frustrating things that don't go your way. You'll be faced with frustrating people who don't want to cooperate or who seem to constantly be providing obstacles for you. You'll be frustrated by your own limitations sometimes. You'll be frustrated in so many ways. And so many times in our lives we think, I'm just going to throw in the towel. I don't want to carry on. But what we found with Shruti Dharma Prabhu is that he never became discouraged. He had so much resilience to just keep coming back no matter what challenges were there. And this is symptomatic of someone who has a deep detachment from the world. When we know that this world is temporary, when we know that this world is full of problems, when we know that this life is not meant to be plain sailing, and we then develop a very deep detachment from the world, then because we no longer have any expectations, we become actually liberated. We become freed from frustration. And then when things don't go our way, it doesn't fluster us. When people don't cooperate with us, it doesn't fluster us. When our plan doesn't work out as we wanted it to work out, it doesn't discourage us. Because we know that this world, that is the nature of this world. So all of this talk of Kali Yuga, of annihilation, of the fact that we're living in a situation which is in one sense going down and we have no control over it, is not meant to be discouraging. But what it's helping us to do is, number one, develop a detachment. And number two, the reason why all of this is given is to help us realize that within the midst of all of this, how amazing it is that we've encountered the spiritual process of chanting the holy names of Krishna. Because practically in the middle of all of the mess of the material world, there's only one good thing. Asti hyeko mahan guna. There's only one good thing in the midst of the entire chaos of the material world. And that good thing is the holy name of Krishna. And you know what? By the grace of Srila Prabhupada, all of us are now in contact with the holy name of Krishna. So then we think, my God, is there a need to be depressed? Because in the midst of all of this, we've got the greatest treasure. And that thing can, mukta sangha param brajet, it can help you to be immune to all of the association of the negativity in this age, param brajet, then it can help you get back to the supreme destination. So, in the midst of all of this talk about Kali Yuga and annihilation, we shouldn't become discouraged, because yes, some people, sometimes devotees get into it, Kali Yuga Katha. Oh my God, it's so bad, and the world's going down, and just see what's happening now in the newspapers. And da da da, and it's getting so terrible. But we can see that yes, it's Kali Yuga, but it's also Chaitanya Yuga. It's also the Yuga in which the way to get back to Godhead is so simple. So simple you may just miss it, Prabhupada said. It's also the yuga which, believe it or not, the demigods are queuing up to take birth in this yuga, because the process of revelation of the highest truth of spiritual realization is so accessible. So in the midst of all of this, we should stay positive. Now in this section of Srimad Bhagavatam, we are going to deal with annihilation. Annihilation is the constant, is the only constant thing in the world, that everything will ultimately be annihilated. There's no other constant. The constant is that everything will be annihilated. This world is, it comes to us, is created to help us realize that we're not meant to be here. Like in fairy tales, it's often said, they lived happily ever after. Now this is actually a very profound statement that is made in fairy tales. They lived happily ever after. Because in this statement reveals the qualities of the soul. They lived. Lived means we all desire to be conscious entities. We all desire to be sentient beings. And this is the quality of the soul known as chit. C-I-T. They lived happily. This is the next innate desire of every soul, to be happy, to experience bliss. And in Sanskrit, this quality of the soul is known as Sat. Sorry, Ananda. And the final quality, ever after. They lived happily ever after. So ever after means that we have an innate desire to be eternal. And this is the quality of the soul known as Sat. So we are Sat, Chit, Ananda. Sat, eternally, eternal. Chit, fully conscious. And Ananda, full of happiness. But there is no question of they lived happily ever after in the material world. Because in the material world, it's not Sat, it's not eternal, it is Asat. Everything is temporary. There's no question of being sentient and cognizant of everything, Chit. We're almost achit. We don't know, our consciousness, our awareness is severely impeded by material body and material limitations in the material world. Therefore, we're not actually fully conscious. We're not able to exhibit that full consciousness. And Ananda, in the material world, there's no question of being Ananda. It's Nirananda. We face so many obstacles. So the annihilation of the material world, the annihilation of this body, is meant to help us understand that this is not our true home. So in this section of Bhagavatam, Sukadeva Goswami explains that there are four types of annihilation. Two types of annihilation are universal annihilation, and two types of annihilation pertain to the individual. On the universal scale, one type of annihilation is known as naimittika, or this is called occasional annihilation, which is the destruction of the universe after a day of Brahma. So if you look in canto number 2, then there's a diagram there with the universal cosmic time scales. So there, a kalpa is a day of Brahma. So at the end of every day of Brahma, everything is annihilated and then later on recreated after the night of Brahma. Another type of annihilation is known as prakritika, which means elemental annihilation, and this takes place at the end of Brahma's life. So this is a more major annihilation, where not only the universes are dismantled, but even the elements are also dismantled. Then Sukadeva Goswami goes on to explain that there are two annihilations which are closer to home. There is something called Nityada, which means annihilation of the body. We're actually experiencing constant change and death of the body, although we don't always perceive it like that. Like sometimes they do these experiments where someone takes a picture of them like every day for like 6 years or something, and then they put every picture in like a slideshow, and then you can see how over time the body is actually completely changing. They say every 7 years every single cell in your body has regenerated, so practically it's a completely new body. So this is known as nityada, or constant annihilation, that the body is being annihilated at every single moment, actually. And then the final type of annihilation is known as atyantika, which means ultimate annihilation, which is that when the living entity realizes their spiritual identity, their connection with Krishna and their relationship with the divine, then they experience ultimate annihilation, which is the annihilation of the material body, and then entrance into the spiritual world where they never have to experience that annihilation again. Because Krishna says, yad gatva nanivartante tadhama paramam mama, that once you go back to the spiritual world, nanivartante, you never come back to this world which is full of repeated birth and death. So this is known as ultimate annihilation, or nityada. So having explained to Parikshit Maharaj all of the different types of annihilation, now what Sukadev Goswami goes on to explain to Parikshit is his own annihilation. Having explained to Parikshit all of these different teachings, now Sukadev Goswami is going to prepare Parikshit for his own annihilation. So this is a very, very historic part of the Srimad Bhagavatam. Of course, we know the first canto was just a preface to the whole work, and the beginning of the second canto is where Parikshit and Sukadev Goswami began to converse. So all the way from the beginning of the second canto up until now, the beginning of the 12th canto, Parikshit and Sukadev Goswami have been having many, many wonderful talks, and now 7 days have passed. Sukadeva looks at Parikshit Maharaj and he's fully confident that Parikshit Maharaj is realized and now he's ready to face the final test of his life. And so Sukadev Goswami reminds Parikshit what his duty is and finally wishes him well and leaves. And as Sukadev Goswami leaves, then Parikshit, in full soberness, walks away from that place, situates himself on the bank of the river, sits himself in meditation, and now prepares to face his ultimate destiny, which is death by curse. So in different Puranas, the story of Maharaj Parikshit's death is told slightly differently, because in different ages of Brahma, the pastime may take place slightly differently. But in the account of the Srimad Bhagavatam, we read the snake bird Takshak came into the assembly where Parikshit Maharaj was, came into the vicinity of where Parikshit Maharaj was meditating, disguised as a Brahmana. And as he approached Parikshit Maharaj and then came closer to Parikshit Maharaj, then Takshak revealed his form, and then immediately with a lethal bite, Takshak contacted the body of Parikshit Maharaj, and as soon as he was bitten by that snake bird Takshak, then Parikshit Maharaj's body went into flames. And as his body went into flames, this effulgent, incredible sight, the demigods began showering flowers, understanding that Parikshit Maharaj was leaving the world in pure, perfect consciousness. And like this, Parikshit Maharaj was body was completely burned up after receiving that snake bite. Everyone was in awe seeing the situation, but one person was incredibly angry. He was he found this situation intolerable, and that was the son of Parikshit Maharaj, who had been enthroned Maharaj Janamejaya. He was the son of Maharaj Parikshit, and he became so angry that his father was subjected to such an experience which caused his departure from the world, that Maharaj Janamejaya began and initiated a sacrifice to kill all the snakes in the universe. So this was his way, his retaliation to the bite of the snake bird Takshak. So as he began this sacrifice, and so many snakes were being killed, until finally Brihaspati came to Maharaj Janamejaya and convinced him that this is not necessary, this is not required, and in this way pacified Maharaj Janamejaya and stopped him from continuing that sacrifice to kill all the snakes. So in this way we learn about how Parikshit Maharaj left the world. We also hear another side story that when Sukadev Goswami left Parikshit Maharaj, and Parikshit Maharaj was making his way to the banks of the river to sit in meditation, then while he was walking to that place, he encountered his mother. Now Parikshit Maharaj's mother, as we know, is Uttara. We heard about Uttara in the first canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, who, when she was pregnant with Parikshit Maharaj in her womb, she prayed to the Lord for protection. And the Lord indeed protected Parikshit Maharaj at that time. So now Parikshit was going, preparing for his death, and he encountered his mother Uttara. Now she was in somewhat of a very depressed situation. First problem for Uttara naturally was that she was foreseeing that her son would die. For a mother to see the death of a son is actually very, very unnatural. It's not according to how life should go. So that was disturbing her very, very much. But something was disturbing her equally. And she looked at her son Parikshit Maharaj and she said, "You heard so many wonderful things in the last 7 days from the glorious mouth of Sukadev Goswami. So much knowledge, so many narrations of the Lords and His devotees, so much incredible inspiration and insight into the world, but I was not able to hear any of that, my dear son." So Uttara looked at Parikshit and then requested him that, "I want you to tell me the essence of what you learned in the 7 days that you heard from Sukadev Goswami." So basically she asked Parikshit to summarize the whole Srimad Bhagavatam to her and deliver her the nectar, the essence of what he heard. So when Parikshit Maharaj did this, of course, how can a son refuse the humble request of a mother, especially in the final moments of life? And so Parikshit Maharaj then began to have a conversation with Uttara. And that conversation lasted just over 1,000 verses. And in that conversation, Parikshit basically disclosed the essential teachings of Srimad Bhagavatam to his mother. And that conversation between Uttara and Parikshit is now what we know as Brihat Bhagavatamrita. So this is a beautiful book that can be read. It's been published by the BBT. Bhagavat, as we know, is the narrations of the Lord and His devotees. Amrita means nectar, and Brihat means great. So the Brihat Bhagavatamrita is literally the great essence, the glorious essence of Srimad Bhagavatam, which was described by Parikshit to his mother Uttara just before he left the world. So now we move on to the third section of the 12th canto, and we know that the conversation between Sukadev Goswami and Parikshit has now concluded, And now in these remaining chapters, we're hearing Suta Goswami and Shonaka and the sages of Naimisharanya directly conversing with each other. So now they've heard about the universal scheme by which everything becomes created and annihilated. This Krishna explains in the Gita, Bhutva Bhutva Praliyata, that the universe is created and destroyed again and again. So as they've heard about all of this, something comes to their mind which puzzles them, which is the story of Markandeya Rishi. Because they've just heard about annihilation, about how everything becomes destroyed, but Markandeya Rishi was a personality who seemed to defy that universal scheme. Markandeya Rishi had lived beyond annihilations of the cosmos. He had lived beyond days of Brahma. And in this way, Markandeya Rishi was an incredible personality. So naturally, Shonaka was inquisitive as to how it was that Markandeya Rishi was able to defy the universal scheme in this way. What did he do that was so special? And then Suta Goswami begins explaining how Markandeya Rishi basically undertook an incredible vow of celibacy. His determination, his discipline, his complete immersion in his vows, in his spiritual vows, meant that he received the boon to basically live for an incredible amount of time. This is very interesting because sometimes we find when someone becomes immersed, when someone becomes absorbed, then what happens is that they're able to transcend material limitations and material boundaries. This happens not just in the spiritual context, but sometimes we even find in the material context that the determination of someone is able to trump whatever other obstacles there may be in the material world. So Markandeya Rishi, by his vow of perpetual celibacy, had maintained his life for a long, long time. Later on, what happened is that Markandeya Rishi was meditating in the forest by his hermitage. You can see this picture in the book. And Indradev sent Kamadev, the transcendental Cupid, along with many, many other celestial damsels, very, very attractive, and they aimed their arrows of allurement at Markandeya Rishi, who was sitting there in his meditation, in his yogic trance. And somehow or other, because of Markandeya's complete meditation and absorption, he was not deviated, he remained undeviated, undisturbed. And in this way, he exhibited a unique level of spiritual focus that impressed the Lord to no end. And therefore, the Lord, as Naranayan Rishis, appeared before Markandeya Rishi and glorified him for his spiritual fixity of purpose. When the Lords appeared before Markandeya Rishi, then they also offered him any boon that he may want to take advantage of. Markandeya Rishi was kind of spiritually absorbed, so he was not really interested in having anything from the Lord. He was very much satisfied in his spiritual practice, and therefore nothing immediately came to his mind. But as the Lord was asking him, then something came to Markandeya Rishi's mind. He had one thing that was intriguing to him. He had somewhat of a interest in something that he couldn't quite figure out. And that one thing that Markandeya Rishi was intrigued about, he presented before the Lord. He said, "My Lord, your material energy, this energy of Maya, which is so powerful, which is so all-pervading, which is so multifaceted that it can create a transcendental arena of illusion for the material living entity, materially conditioned living entities to try and enjoy in this world. Can you please give me a vision of this Maya? Can you please give me some insight into what this Maya is, how it functions, and how it bewilders the living entities? And in this way, Markandeya Rishi had some kind of interest in understanding the workings of Maya. Now, as Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, Maya Dhyakshena Prakriti Suyate Sacharacharam Hetunanena Konteya Jagat Viparivartate. Krishna says this energy, the material energy of Maya, is working under my direction and dictating the wanderings of all living beings. So, because Maya is under the jurisdiction of the Lord had no problem in fulfilling Markandeya Rishi's desire to have a vision of Maya. And so the Lord acquiesced. And one day Markandeya Rishi was walking through the forest and a great storm suddenly appeared. So what happens at the time of annihilation is that there is a universal deluge. The waters of universal devastation arise and basically everything is inundated. And so it seemed as though this was happening. The environment was becoming overcome by all of this water. There were storms, there were winds, there was carnage everywhere, and everything was becoming destroyed. Markandeya Rishi was walking through this destructive site, not knowing what to make of it. And finally, as he was walking, hungry, thirsty, fatigued, tired, confused, then he came upon a blossoming tree. Now, in the midst of everything he was seeing, this blossoming tree seemed somewhat out of place. He walked up a little closer and it had all these beautiful fruits on it. And as he walked a little closer, he saw that on one of the leaves there was a beautiful, charming, enchanting and effulgent little baby who was sucking his toe. So as Markandeya Rishi walked up to this leaf and saw this charming young boy, then naturally he was drawn towards this boy. And as he inched forward trying to get closer to that charming boy, then immediately, vroomp, he became sucked into the body of that boy. And as he was sucked into the body of that boy, his vision completely changed. Inside the body of that young boy, Markandeya Rishi saw the universe exactly as it was before the devastation that he had witnessed. And as he was enjoying that sight of seeing the universe exactly as it was before, then vroomp, again, he was thrust outside of the baby again, and he found himself back in his original hermitage where he would do his meditation and so on and so forth. And in this way, everything went back to normal. So in this way, the Lord showed Markandeya that vision of Maya, how this inconceivable energy, Krishna says, Devi hiya shugunamai mama maya duratyaya, that this mama maya duratyaya, this powerful energy of Maya, is so difficult for anyone to overcome. It's actually not possible. But it's only possible, mameva ye prapadyante mayam etam taranti te, that if you surrender to Krishna, who is controlling Maya, then one can easily cross beyond. So in this way, Markandeya Rishi really shows us that, I mean, we all have an intrigue for Maya. even though we're in spiritual life, even though we're somewhat happy practicing Krishna consciousness, and even though we do have the realization that Maya and all of the various offerings of Maya are limited and temporary, we still have this intrigue to try to go and see Maya again and again and interact with Maya. And so this pastime of Markandeya Rishi wanting to have a vision of Maya reminds us that there is nothing really there. There is nothing really of substance in Maya. We'll always be left, let down, frustrated. Whenever we try to find enjoyment in Maya, one of three things happens. Either we don't get what we're looking for, or number two, we get what we're looking for and it's not really what we thought it would be. Or number three, we get what we're looking for, it's actually brings some pleasure, but later on, immediately with the waves of time, that happiness of Maya disappears. And therefore, any interaction with Maya will never really bring us the happiness and satisfaction that we so much seek and yearn for. So Markandeya Rishi really is an evolved personality. In the Puranas, we actually find another story of Markandeya Rishi, who once entered an assembly of sages. So in this assembly of sages, many, many eminent personalities had come. And as Markandeya Rishi walked into that assembly of sages, they all stood up in respect, knowing that because of Markandeya Rishi's incredible austerity and sacrifice, he was able to overcome universal annihilation, which was a great achievement. I mean, that was something very, very astounding. So as he came into the assembly, they asked Markandeya Rishi to enlighten them, because the natural etiquette is that in any assembly of evolved spiritualists, the most evolved spiritualist should address everyone else. So as they said that to Markandeya Rishi, Markandeya Rishi agreed them that the most senior should enlighten them. So he looked around and he pointed at Vasistha. Vasistha Rishi was there, and Vasistha Rishi was having a small boy in his lap. Now, who was that boy in his lap? That was Parashara Muni. Parashara Muni is the father of Vyasadeva. So in this assembly of sages, Vasistha was sitting there, and he was sitting with a small boy in his lap, which was Parashara Muni. Parashara Muni was sitting in Vasistha's lap because his own father had passed away. And Markandeya looked at Parashara Muni and asked his age. Now Parashara Muni at this point was only 7 years old, and Markandeya Rishi had the boon to live for 7 kalpas, or days of Brahma. So Markandeya Rishi then made the point that Parashara is actually the most senior in this assembly. Everyone was baffled. How can you say such a thing? Because Markandeya Rishi made the point to all of them that one's age is not determined by how many years they've lived in this world, but by how many moments of remembrance of Krishna they've had. So if you add up all of the moments of remembrance of Krishna in your life and total that, then that is your age. And Markandeya Rishi looked at Parashara Muni and he said, he has not forgotten Krishna for even one moment. Whereas I may have been living so long, but my immersion was not as exalted as his. And in this way, Markandeya Rishi, in a very beautiful way, made this point that it's not the number of years in your life that count, but it's the amount of spiritual life in those years that you have in this world. That's really what counts. And in this sense, Markandeya Rishi said, I am not the oldest, Parashara Muni is the oldest, even though by your material vision he looks to be the youngest. So now we come to the very final section of Srimad Bhagavatam, ending the epic. So now Suta Goswami has narrated all the conversations between Maharaj Parikshit and Sukadev Goswami. Sages of Naimisharanya are fully satisfied by everything that they've heard. And now, in these final few chapters, Suta Goswami, first what he does is he summarizes all the different cantos, all the different narrations, just to give the sages a final recap. And then Suta Goswami, again, what he does is he underlines the, highlights the glory of Srimad Bhagavatam as a book. In a beautiful verse he says, Nimnaganam yatha ganga devanam achyuto yatha Vaishnavanam yatha sambhu purananam idam tatha. Nimnaganam yatha ganga, amongst all rivers Ganga is to be considered foremost. Devanam achyuto yatha, amongst all the gods Achyuta or Krishna is to be considered most exalted. Vaishnavanam yatha sambhu, amongst all Vaishnavas, Shiva is most glorious. Purananam idam tatha, and amongst the 400,000 verses of the Puranas, the many, many different Puranas that are there, Bhagavatam is considered the foremost of all of those Puranas. In another verse in this final chapter of the 12th canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, we find another beautiful verse. Srimad Bhagavatam Puranam Amalam Yad Vaishnavanam Priyam Yasmin Paramahamsyamekam Amalam Jnanam Param Ghiyate Tatra Jnana Viraga Bhakti Sahitam Nishkarmyam Aviskritam Tatrinvan Supatan Vicharana Paro Bhaktya Vimuchyanara. So here Suta Goswami explains that Srimad Bhagavatam Puranam Amalam Yad Vaishnavanam Priyam. This Bhagavatam is a spotless book and it's very dear to every single Vaishnavas because it describes pure and supreme knowledge. Bhagavatam will help us, in this verse it's saying, Bhagavatam will help us find the way to become free from all entanglement and develop knowledge, renunciation and devotion. And finally, it's explained, Tatra jnana viraga bhakti sahitam neshkarmyam avishkritam tatrinvan supatan vicharana paro bhaktya vimuchyan nara. That anyone who seriously tries to understand Srimad Bhagavatam, who properly hears it and chants it with devotion, becomes completely liberated. And then in the final verse of Srimad Bhagavatam, 12:13:23, we find the final conclusion of Bhagavatam. Nama sankirtanam yasya sarva papa pranashanam pranamo dukha samanas tam namami harim param. Translation: I offer my respectful obeisances unto the Supreme Lord Hari, the congregational chanting of whose holy names destroys all sinful reactions, and the offering of obeisances unto whom relieves all material suffering. So here the Bhagavatam ends by again reminding us that the holy name of Krishna is ultimately the only way that we will be able to escape this world and come face to face with Krishna. Right now we can imagine that there is a big wall between us and Krishna, a big wall between us and the spiritual world, a big wall between us and all the great Vaishnavas that we hear of. And what happens is that this wall is made of many, many bricks. And what happens is that every day when we chant Krishna's names, if we're able to do it with absorption, with attention, with somewhat of an attraction and desperation, then every day when we chant, it's like taking one brick out of that wall. And when we take one brick out of the wall, we still can't fully see what's on the other side. But we get somewhat of a glimpse. We get somewhat of a glimpse of Krishna, somewhat of a glimpse of the spiritual world, somewhat of a glimpse of what pure Krishna consciousness feels like. And every day as we reapply ourselves to the chanting and take one more brick out, another brick out, another brick out, then what we'll find is that at one point when enough bricks are taken out, then one day we will chant and it will be that one brick you take out and the whole wall will collapse. And the whole wall will collapse and will be revealed with a vision of Krishna, revealed with a vision of the spiritual world, revealed with actual, true, genuine, heartfelt, uncontaminated, unalloyed Krishna consciousness. And so reading Srimad Bhagavatam and chanting the holy name of Krishna and sharing this with as many people as possible is the sure way to spiritual salvation. There is, it's really as simple as that. Sometimes we think we have to do something extraordinary in our spiritual life to somehow get our way back to Godhead. Of course, we do want to do extraordinary things to please Krishna, to please Srila Prabhupada, but the most extraordinary activity we can do is to become immersed in Srimad Bhagavatam, to become immersed in the holy name. And in order to become immersed in these things, we must spend time developing our relationship with these things. Because once you get more and more familiar with Srimad Bhagavatam, the knowledge and the hearing of Bhagavatam will become more and more relishable. But if you remain a stranger to the Bhagavatam, then your sense of relish of the Bhagavatam will only will remain fairly superficial. In the same way, we have to spend time with the holy name, days where we chant more rounds, days where we dedicate ourselves to chanting in a more absorbed and concentrated way for longer periods of time, and in this way we develop our connection. So I hope the course and these discussions on Srimad Bhagavatam have been of some use and value. I feel very, very fortunate that all of you gave me the opportunity to share something with you. Unqualified as I am, still a student of the Bhagavatam, I'm always a student of the Bhagavatam, and not really fully qualified to share with you, but still all of you gave me that opportunity and encouraged me, so I feel very blessed. And I think we're all becoming more and more closer to Srimad Bhagavatam through this continued exposure. So as I mentioned in the beginning of today's little class, that I hope it won't be too long before again we're all together discussing Srimad Bhagavatam. Because when we discuss Srimad Bhagavatam, everything is okay. In a beautiful verse of the Bhagavatam, it's mentioned, Yatredyante katamrishtas drishnaya prashamogata nirvedam yatrabhuteshu no dvego yatrakaschana. Yatre dhyante katham rishtas, wherever devotees are together discussing Bhagavat katha, trishnaya prashamogata, they feel immediately all material hankerings go away. Nirvedam yatra bhuteshu, their enmity, their envy towards other living beings goes away. Everything becomes clear. Prabhupada says in the translation, at least for the time being. Because when we're together discussing Bhagavatam in that transcendental bubble, then at least for the time being, Everything in the material world, all the problems and the chaos fades away. So we pray that one day we can constantly be living in the world of Srimad Bhagavatam. And then we'll be living in this world, but not really living in this world, because we'll be functioning in this world, but we'll be constantly living in Krishna's world. And that is what Bhagavatam wants us to do. That is what the mission of Bhagavatam is to do, to usher us into the spiritual world, to live with Krishna and the Vaishnavas eternally. So thank you very much again. Our debt of gratitude to Srila Prabhupada, who put every last bit of energy into translating Bhagavatam for our benefit. And as time goes by, we realize how much of a precious gift he gave us. So let us take full advantage, and we hope to be with everyone again very, very soon discussing Srimad Bhagavatam. Please forgive me for my shortcomings, my offenses, if I created any. And please bless me that I can begin to live many of the things that we discuss, because Bhagavatam is not just meant to be read. Bhagavatam is not just meant to be studied. Bhagavatam is not just meant to be distributed, but ultimately Bhagavatam is meant to be lived. We have to become living Bhagavatams, and that is the supreme goal of life. Grantharaj Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai, Srila Prabhupada ki jai, all of you ki jai. Thank you very much. Until the next time, Hare Krishna.